Morning. Recorded at Neptune's Machine on Wolf Island, the 10-song collection covers themes of love, trauma, and recovery. The arrangements range from sombre to uplifting, driven by Fever's poignant lyricism and deftly fingerpicked guitar. The album, which shines a light on the intricate balance between bleakness and hope, will be available on streaming platforms and as a CD. Anthea Fever is also having an album release show on October 19th at Next Church at 7:30 p.m., supported by Alexander Gallant. In the meantime, let's enjoy this song by Anthea Fever called Bedtime Story on Release Radar, right here on CFRC.
I've been walking heart in hand, and I've been looking for someone to wear their beating heart upon their sleeve. In my chest there's a hole, it don't take much to make it whole. Just tell me that you'll walk here next to me and be my bedtime story. I've been reading lots of books, and boy, I think it would be good if you would read the words out loud to me. If the pages come alive, then we'll have nothing left to hide, and we could write it away, and you could be my bedtime story. Your head is a secret garden, darling. Oh, I beg your pardon. Won't you take a walk around with me? Oh, the trees, they start to dance, and I have never been entranced like this before, and that is why you'll be my bedtime story. Oh, come to my bed, pour your fairy dust over my head, leave your shadow in my drawer, and take me by the hand. My bedtime story. Tell me all the places you've been and every little thing you've seen, and maybe now you won't do that alone. You can show me all your dark, and I'll let you see all my scars, and each of us will call each other home, my bedtime story. We can delve into the forest, everybody will ignore us. You can build a nest up in the trees. I've never been afraid of dying, but I am afraid of trying, just to be shoved back on my knees, my bedtime story. I can teach you how to rhyme, and you can teach me how to fly, and we will be poets up in the sky. You've spent your life believing you were only made for leaving. I'd stay by your side until I die, my bedtime story. To my bed, pour your fairy dust over my head, leave your shadow in my drawer, take me by the hand out the door. Oh, come to my bed, pour your fairy dust over my head, leave your shadow in my drawer, take me by the hand. Bedtime story.
Hello and good morning, everyone. It is now 11 a.m. on Thursday morning. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, CFRC.ca, broadcasting from the basement of Carruthers Hall on the campus of Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Rue, and you're listening to the CFRC Live Sessions, a show where the Live Sessions crew brings you musical performances recorded right here in CFRC Studio A by artists from in and around Kingston and all around the world. Today we have a session with the Kingston-based pop-rock band Sugar Pills, made up of local musicians and songwriters, ahead of releasing their debut single Nepo Baby that came out last week, and in the lead up to their debut album, the band joined Hayden in studio to talk all about songwriting, the Kingston music scene, recording up at the Wilderness's Evergreen Studios, and of course the upcoming EP. You can find them on Instagram, they are at The Sugar Pills Band. To keep up with the CFRC Live Sessions, follow us online. We are at CFRC Live Sessions on YouTube and Instagram, and you can find past performances by a wide variety of guest artists on our YouTube channel. If you would like to join the Live Sessions crew for interviewing, audio tech, filming, videography, audio or video production, or anything else that you can think of, please reach out to us on Instagram, or our email address is livesessions@cfrc.ca. You can also reach out to us if you're an artist who would like to do a live session with us here at the station. If you're interested in sponsoring the CFRC Live Sessions and becoming a proud supporter of one of Kingston's most cutting-edge radio programs, please reach out and let's talk. And of course, don't forget to come back every Thursday at 11 a.m. to catch another new live session that we've done.
Here comes Liam, the best bringing of Kingston's sonically diverse music scene
with Michael
and
Zizek,
bringing you touring
artists from all around the world. But for now, here's Hayden live in session with the Sugar Pills with their very first song that they played for us, Cry Baby, here on CFRC.
Just give you, so it'll be 1, 2, 3, you're such a...
Okay.
You're such a cry baby, and I know you like to lie, baby, so go ahead and make them all hate me, I bet they already did. And I'll admit it's a little impressive, how you turn simply being pathetic, right into your entire aesthetic, how poetic. And it'll drag you down if you let it. Stray's coming back cause you're petty. And it'll scratch if you try to pet it. So don't pet it. Can't believe I called you mine. After all the warnings, I'm such a crybaby. And I know you like to lie, baby. So go ahead and make them all hate me. I bet they already do. Wasting no time, baby. You do everything that it was you, baby. Let us take all the quick shots.
We're here on CFRC Live Sessions, and you just heard the Sugar Pills song Cry Baby. We've got the Sugar Pills in the studio here to talk about it all, their upcoming EP, four songs. But first of all, let's get into who the Sugar Pills are as a band, because you guys have been around for a decent amount of time now in Kingston. I read online about you describe yourselves as a pop rock band. How did you sort of arrive at that being the genre for the Sugar Pills?
As far as how we classified it, that's always been kind of a struggle, as any band would probably say the same thing. We came into creating the band with the idea that we needed something as an outlet to do all the fun music that we couldn't or felt like embarrassed to do in our other projects.
Yeah, so didn't fit in.
Yeah, so we just thought, like, we need to do something fun, and we started writing, and when you start writing with guitars and drums, it ends up being a little rock, and we always try to keep it with that pop angle. We want to get people up and moving and on their feet.
Yeah, I think it makes sense to have fun be the first adjective to describe the Sugar Pills music, because every, like, you have so many, like, funny one-liner sort of bits in
the song. Love a one-liner.
Yeah. We try.
Yeah.
Is it like a fully collaborative, like, writing process, or how do you guys put together these songs? Do you guys bring in a guitar riff or a funny line or something like that?
Honestly, every song's different. Like, Sydney does a lot of the writing, and then the songs, and then we'll piece together the instrument, or, you know, I'll write the lyrics and somebody else will write the guitar, or, like, we have one that we're working on right now that was a guitar riff that Isaiah wrote, and then I was like, oh, that would be cool if we sampled that, so then that turned into the whole song. I wrote lyrics on top of that, but it is pretty collaborative, I'd say, and then there are some that are kind of more personal projects as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure.
So when it comes to the song Cry Baby, the one that we just heard there, like, how long has that song been cooking for? Because I know it's going to be coming on your upcoming EP, which we'll get into later in the show.
But, yeah.
How long has that song been?
It's cooked. It's marinated.
That one's like the OG Sugar Pill song for sure.
I was going to say, because I first saw you at, I think at the Astros show.
Grad Club.
Long time ago. Yeah. At the Grad Club. And I'm pretty sure you played that song there.
Yeah. That's definitely like our first original, I think. I have like a weird video from like one of our first practices where it sounds so different, which is so weird.
Yeah. Sid and I sat in her kitchen, and she like had the lyrics, and she sent me a voice memo, and then I just laid down the chords on an acoustic guitar, and that was like probably a year and 6 months ago or something.
Yeah,
like that,
maybe
like
more for that one.
Ago. Yeah.
Was that before the band even started?
Before we even were booking or playing things, it just, we would write together. So
Very cool. You guys, like, I mean, like I said, like, humor and fun is like a big element of your songwriting, and I definitely hear that in the next song that we're gonna hear. This song is also baby themed, maybe even more so, actually.
Yeah, true.
Tell us about Nepo Baby, the next song we're gonna hear.
I think that one started with us being like, this would be a funny thing to write a song about.
Yeah, it was kind of like a buzzword on, like, the socials, and we were like...
Yeah, it was, like, coming out who was a Nepo baby.
Like, and it's, like, it's funny on this big grand scheme of, like, we're talking about Nepo babies in, like, Hollywood, and then it's funny being from a small town, and it's, like, putting the finger in the same way. And we were just like, it would be funny to, like, write a song, you know, based on that idea of privilege and what it means in the music scene.
There definitely is something funny about, like, a small town Nepo baby, or, like, at least making the play off of that, like, bigger world concept for Kingston.
Yeah, exactly. Acting like we're really a part of it. I feel like it really started with, didn't Hailey Bieber wear a t-shirt that just said Nepo Baby? And then I think that was like the beginning of it being mainstream.
We were
media.
Like, oh, that would be such good merch. But
yes. True. Maybe she'll sponsor us.
All right, well, let's hear it now. Nepo Baby by the Sugar Pills.
Bet your mommy keeps that participation trophy on the mantle, 'cause losing you can't handle. Bet your daddy changes all of your B's to straight A's with shiny dollar bills, 'cause he knows you never will. And I know you think that your name's up in lights, because you really earned it, because you really deserve it. And I hate to be the one to break your stride, but no one in this town's ever gonna let you. Oh, everything you say, and not their heads like they care, laughing without hesitation. Warning, got them reservations, and you always have time to spend smoothies and meditation. When's it gonna be my turn to earn some reparations? Don't tell me it's lonely.
The Sugar Pills, and you just heard Nepo Baby.
That song is one of those types of songs that when you play it live, it's like instantly like sing-alongable. Like by the second or third chorus, like easily the audience can be along with you singing it. And even I just heard, like, as you guys were sitting it, like taking down all this stuff here, you guys are singing your own song, like, it's stuck in your own head.
We're so obsessed with ourselves.
That's a good thing. Like, when you make a song, do you think about like that pop catchiness angle? Because it's something that's important, like when people are walking out of a show and they're kind of like humming the melody. It's a lot of fun.
Right, yeah. I'd say it's something that we almost think about after the fact, even. Like, I'll come to you with an idea that's almost not completely finished, and then it'll be like, how would this be better or more catchy, I guess, yeah. More chorus-like. So I think it's something that either comes naturally and you know it already fits like that, or we work towards it.
It's a lot of, instead of building up, it's a lot of like taking away the layers to really simplify it, I think. And like the highlight of that song for me is like Isaiah's little doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, and it's just like in an open pocket in the song, and it feels kind of like Weezer-ish, and like it's got Teenage Dirtbag vibes,
yeah,
too. Like,
definitely.
We lean into that kind of like, I don't know, early 2000s aesthetic with that one, and
yeah.
Had just kind of like let ourselves have fun with it.
Mm-hmm. I definitely hear that early 2000s like indie pop or alt sort of like thing in your music. Are there certain artists like that you guys turn to in maybe in a moment of like writer's block or something like that? Like, you go back in your playlist and find something?
We were talking about this today. Yeah. I don't know if there's super specific people. I find when I'm writing lyrically, like Beach Bunny, I find super simple, but effective, the lyrics. So I find a lot of that inspiring, but it's not, I wouldn't say it necessarily inspires our sound. So it's really different, yeah. In terms of writing versus the actual music sound.
There's this band out of Toronto called Baby Girl, and I'm like a super fan of them, and they just are really good at simplifying pop and just making it like super open and like never feels too crowded, and it gets the job done. And so I, every time I'm, because I'm like an overwriter, I don't know about you, I'm like a chronic overwriter. Like, just shut up, Evan. But with my songwriting, it's always about like you know, take it back. What can you take out? So for me, trying to get that pop influence is just like thinking about what would they do?
Yeah, I can see that.
Sweet. Now, Nepo Baby, that song there is going to be the first single off of your upcoming EP. And you guys mentioned that you had recorded it at the Wilderness's brand new Evergreen studio there. Was that your first time all in the studio together?
Yeah, it was.
It was cool.
And in a brand new studio. How did that all go for you?
It was really great. We had Max Tinline helping us for most of it. And we were lucky to be in there kind of before I think it was fully out that it was up and running.
Yeah, we were the guinea pigs.
Yeah, in a good way. Yeah, it was really great. We recorded like kind of demos at Caleb's place, but it was the first time we had the opportunity to.
And it was cool because Max, like, he filled in for guitar for us during a period. It was prior to Isaiah, right? Yeah, there was like a transition period there. So he was kind of like fired up to get these songs done, and he had like experience playing with them, right? So he was really excited to get working on the project, and you can totally feel in the recording he'd be like, no, I think you could do that better, like go back and like, oh, that sounded really good. So it was cool having somebody who knew the song so like intimately working on the project.
Yeah,
that's very cool. Like having Max come in there, like that's a super inside Kingston connection.
Yeah. Totally.
Speaking of Kingston connections, the next song that you're going to play, tell us about this one, because as you guys were, as I was hearing this song, like there's so many funny things in here for Kingston people to pick out.
Yeah, I would say this one definitely leans the most Kingston in terms of references. We joke that it's kind of an inside look at a night out with the Sugar Pills.
It's kind of like a freeze frame. It's
yeah.
Like if you drop
so much going on.
Like one or like maybe like 12:48, like in the middle of what night is it? Thursday night.
In the night. This is what you'd see.
You'd see the freeze frame of what we're all up to on that night, basically.
Yeah.
At the toucan.
All right, let's hear it now.
Try to make it to two if you can.
Sugar Pill.
We're the Sugar Pills.
And you just heard our song, Sugar Pill.
That song, before the break, you mentioned that it's kind of like a moment in time. Like, you even mentioned specific places and locations of Kingston. I don't even need to ask if that was, like, inspired by a specific night, because it's, like, so general. Like, I'm sure that that circumstance has arisen, like, a million times. Is it, like...
No.
No, never.
I've never
sold
a when it comes to bonding as a band, like, is there almost equally parts of playing on stage and, like, the whole experience of doing the show? Because this is almost a story about, like, the outside parts of the show, like, setting up and leaving and
yeah.
This and that.
It's interesting, like, because, like, hanging out as a band, like, we're split between different cities, and we're kind of, like, now spending more time hanging out as a band outside of just the process, but you get to know each other so well in doing, like, load-in and sound check for gigs, because there's always something that goes wrong, there's always, like, personalities, it always, like something always happens, or they're like, you forget a chord, like, I'm guilty of that, and then you just get to know each other, like, in such a, like, catalyzed way. Everything happens so quickly. So we've set up at the Toucan, we've set up at the Mansion, we've set up at all these different places in town, and every experience has been, like, very formative for getting to know each other as a
yeah,
as a
you
person.
Get to know the quirks of each venue, yeah. Too, which becomes kind of the jokes of, I mean, there could be more than there are yeah. in the song,
part
but,
two.
Like,
yeah.
little things that are different from place to place. And then also, like, if you play late, you don't get to hang out as much before the venue closes.
Just go home and sleep.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is a lot of that load in, load out. And then when you get that night of, like, you're kind of done and you get to enjoy the second band, that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you guys have played with a load of different bands. You've played with the Astros, you've played with Nison. How do you guys, when a band is reaching out to you, to connect, like, how do you guys sort of do you have any kind of editorializing process of, like, vetting, you know, who do you want to play with?
It's tough to, like, know, you know, we're pretty sure of our sound, so, like, we feel confident in that, and we know also, because we're Kingston residents, we're, like, we know what that gig is going to be like on
yeah.
this night and that night. So we kind of know us, but it's tough when people from, like, other cities reach out and they're like, oh, you didn't want to play this night. And we're like, you know, as the openers, here's what that's going to look like. We're a little too embedded into the scene sometimes. We know it a little too well. But it's, how do we just look for fun. We look for good personalities. We look for, like, people who are taking risks, because mm-hmm. that's what we're trying to do. And, like, those two bands you mentioned earlier are both artists that have, like, they're just easy to work with, lovable people, and they just have so much fun on stage, and I think that's what we're all about, right?
Yeah, and, like, based on what we think their fan base is gonna like, if
yeah.
they'll be into what we do, because we want to be honest with the main band as well, if we think we're not gonna bring the right vibe for them in general.
Yeah,
so.
We've had, like heavy, like, metal bands reach out,
like,
and be like, they're like, let's open, and we're like, yeah, it'll be a little mix.
Might be
there.
A little bit of a shift.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But I think you guys have the type of show where you can rock, like, almost anything. Like, I've seen you guys, like, late at night at Blue Martini. I've seen you guys, like, early opening up. And I think you guys kind of, like, are able, I don't know, your sound is general and appealing enough. And your sort of
Thank
image
you.
And dancing is fun.
Thanks.
Yeah. We try to match the vibe.
It's about
yeah.
the people.
Yeah.
Before we go, Sydney, I have to ask you about your boots that you love to wear
on
stage.
Oh, my boots, yes.
I mean, did you pick that out intentionally as, like, this is going to be, like, an iconic look for our band? Or is it just, like, a piece of clothing you happen to own?
It just happened. They were a Facebook Marketplace find, actually. And I can't remember the girl's name. That'd be so funny if I give her a shout out. But, like, I remember we were slowly getting into, like, well, we knew the logo was pink for sure. And Sugar Pills is definitely, like, that fun, like, pink's a fun color for that. So I just feel like they're a perfect mix of pop and rock, like the dark leather, but then still a heel and a pump, and then the bright pink hearts. So they just felt right, and now they work around a lot of different outfit styles. So
that's excellent.
Yeah.
Kingston Sweethearts.
Yes, and I love that photographers have just started taking pictures of only the boots. I'm like, okay, thank you. They're always the coolest shots. Yeah.
That's amazing. All right, well, Sugar Pills, thank you so much for coming in, and we're excited for your EP coming soon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We're the Sugar Pills, and you're listening to
CFRC 101.9 FM.
Today on Wings.
What does it mean to parent, to give birth to shelter, life during a genocide?
The guest is Shireen Sekely, editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Since its founding in 1971, JPS has been the English-language academic journal of record on Palestinian affairs. Elizabeth Robinson interviewed Professor Sakely in September 2024 about her fully documented and heartrending editor's note in the current quarterly edition.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Here now is host Elizabeth Robinson introducing Professor Sakely for a program that first aired on campus community radio station KCSB at the University of California in Santa Barbara.
Shireen Sakely is an historian of note. She is a professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She is the editor of a number of things, including the Journal of Palestine Studies. She has been co-editor with a historian of renown, Rashid Khalidi, and has recently become the sole editor and has written and is writing editorial notes for each journal to sort of serve as a guide for readers. And for those of us who are not readers of the journal, to know that we can find a lot of history there and a lot more than we're getting in our daily newspapers. With that, I want to say, Shireen Sakely, thank you so much for being with me this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What I thought we would do is go straight to the piece that you've written for the Journal of Palestine Studies. That is listed as the editor's note, and which I think typifies for me your work around your thought and your activism of bringing people inside, humanizing history. I never can understand how people can find history boring. It's just usually a bad historian, maybe. But let's begin with the beginning of your editor's note, if you would.
Of course. 5 kilos of potatoes. Abed's 3-year-old Lur begged her father to play their favorite game. He used to roll her up in a blanket and carry her high in the sky. Abed was the seller and Lur the vegetable. These days, his daughter's pleas filled Abed with dread, triggering images of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip gathering fragments of their loved ones. He looked on to the genocide from Jaffa, where structural racism, violence, and dispossession of Palestinians had only heightened since October. He weighed his options. Do we cling to our land or ensure our children's safety and leave? The dread grew deeper with the knowledge that parents in the Gaza Strip did not have this choice. The Israeli and U.S. genocide of Palestinians in Gaza has killed at least 16,500 children. 21,000 children are lost, detained, or buried in unmarked graves. 17,000 children are orphaned by or separated from their families. 4,000 children are missing under the rubble. Since October 2023, 20,000 Palestinian babies have been born into a world under active destruction. They have been sentenced to death in the womb. Since October, miscarriages have surged by 300%. Maternal and neonatal mortality has quadrupled. In every case of C-section reported to Doctors Without Borders, the baby has died. The newborns who come into a world of thirst and famine will drink less than a fraction of a cup of water and eat as little as 245 calories a day. They will suffer from diarrhea and vomiting. They might contract polio. They will be subject to Israeli snipers who have reiteratively cut down young life. What does it mean to parent, to give birth to shelter life during a genocide?
That from your piece in the Journal of Palestine Studies. One of the most notable things about it, aside from the weight of the content, is the weight of the footnotes. This maybe 5,000-word essay has 100 footnotes, or almost 100 footnotes. And it speaks to your practice as an historian, but it also speaks to your reality as a Palestinian and to the denialism of your existence that we should address straight away. Why did you, I mean, like every sentence almost in the first parts has a footnote.
Yeah, I work with a wonderful editor who said to me, you know, these footnotes, there's so many of them, maybe we can streamline some of them. And I said, no, it's very intentional that every sentence has a source, because for a number of reasons. The first reason is the reality of genocide and Nakba denialism, which is ubiquitous in this moment, that after 11 months of ceaseless murder, mass collective punishment, and ongoing, essentially, bombardment of what we can now characterize as a concentration camp where people are being starved and bombed at the same time, in the face of that denialism, and in the face of the ubiquitous attempts to silence us on every single level, the work here is evidentiary. It is drawing inspiration from something Edward Said wrote about in the late 1970s about a discipline of detail. What is a discipline of detail? And how can the work of detail empower us to continue the fight every day for Palestinian freedom and Palestinian liberation? More broadly speaking, I think that these editorial notes that I've worked on with Rashid since I started in 2020 were really centered around uplifting Palestinian voices. And here the plea is for all the folks who are really centering Palestine in beautiful ways and mobilizing it as a space of political imagination. This is a plea to really do the work of reading what Palestinians themselves are writing, how Palestinians themselves are testifying. And so part of what is happening here is a kind of layering of those voices and an invitation to explore and center those voices, to really do the work of mobilizing for Palestine by centering Palestinians. Lastly, I would say that part of this work for me is also a kind of feminist citational practices, a feminist citational practice that invites us all to think about authorship and writing as collaborative, that invites us all to think about how knowledge production is a space itself of collaborative, collective work. And this, I hope that these editors' notes really serve as a kind of roundup of all of the knowledge production that is happening in the face of what sometimes appears as a kind of imperative of single authorship. I think feminist citational practices are really crucial in times of genocide and in all times.
Well, I just have to make one aside here, which shouldn't be necessary, but most universities, colleges, high schools, etc., require you to work alone or tend to deny the efficacy of whatever you've done if you've done it collectively. And it is such an impoverishing idea. And I think as feminist practice, it's extremely important to acknowledge that. I thank you.
Yeah, and I think all the media workers, yourself, and the program, understand that often silent work of editorship that really goes into helping craft words and craft knowledge. And it is a craft. It's not, so I like to think of that craft as really centered around that kind of acknowledgement of what's brought us into the room, what's made that room possible.
As you speak, and as has been practiced here at the University of California campus by groups like Academics for Justice in Palestine, there's an insistence on bringing those voices forward and also preventing them from being buried once again. One of the things that I think of as you're speaking about this is how much excavation we always are doing in terms of anything beyond the normative mainstream media, academy, what have you, to say, no, that's not the whole story.
Yeah.
So I'm doubly appreciative of that and of your insistence of it when you deal with students, because I've seen that too. When other people can't talk to oppositional voices, you invite them in. So thank you. The denialism, however, begins right now by dating everything to October 7th. And as you're talking, I can remember the intifadas in the past when the IDF practice, the Israeli Defense Forces so-called practice, was to maim people. And this is not unique to Israel. Warfare often understands, or the makers of warfare, that a wounded colleague or soldier, whatever, demands the attention of several people. And so it's intentional. But I think it's easily seen right now in Gaza and increasingly on the West Bank. And it goes way back. So just to say, this is not about the last year. It's about decades. But with that, there are also particular practices that reiterate the lethality, the genocidal impulse here. And part of that is to look at women undergoing or attempting to undergo childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we can return to the article. You can comment otherwise, but also to return to the article.
Mm-hmm.
On Wings, you are listening to a discussion between radio host Elizabeth Robinson of campus radio station KCSB at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a distinguished history professor there, Shireen Sekely, who is also affiliated with the Department of Feminist Studies. Sekely is the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. The spark for their discussion is the editor's note Sekely wrote for Volume 53 of the journal, published in August 2024.
Well, I want to say just a couple points on the Nakba denialism, and then I'll get into what I hope in each of these pieces to do. And this is, a practice that Ishida and I did together that I'm trying to get deeper into, which is really try to take these editors' notes into a space where we're seeing them from the perspective of people trying to survive on the ground. And as my friend and colleague Cecilia Mendez pointed out to me, that what I'm trying to do in this piece is accompany people as they suffer. Before we get to that, I'll just say three points about the Nakba denialism. As you point out, there's a long history of this. And one of the things that is so challenging in this moment for Palestinians and historians of Palestine is to see the multiple continuities of the last 100 years, right? Of to see how the kinds of propaganda and denialism is so part of a piece of a longer structure of denialism and of the Nakba itself in 1948, right? And I think here it's really important to think about, for all the listeners, our own complicity in that denialism, because it is everywhere. It is in the government, in the complicity of US, UK, German, French, so many governments that are arming this genocide and giving it impunity, particularly the United States and the international, on the international scale. It is in the media, in journals like The Atlantic that espouse, you know, viewpoints that it's possible to kill children legally. It's in the New York Times style guidelines that restrict the use of the terms genocide and ethnic cleansing when it comes to Palestinians. It's in people who argue, as they have on the pages of The New Yorker, that, you know, Arabs and Palestinians are somehow not rapable, right? This is an argument that, you know, weaponizes the rapes on October 7 as somehow grounds to justify genocide, while denying the systemic rape of Palestinian men and women that Israel is conducting. It is the fact that in the so-called, you know, House of the People, we see an attempt to bar the State Department from using international affairs budget to funds to even cite figures. We saw the spectacle of Netanyahu basically presenting himself as heroic and righteous in the House of the People in the United States for conducting a genocide. We saw it in the Democratic National Convention when, as Noor Arakat put it, a genocide of massive proportions was transformed into a hostage crisis. You know, really shameful. I think we as historians understand that it is much easier to take the right stand in retrospect when the moral urgency of standing up has passed. And I think the moral urgency of standing up to Nakba denialism is very intense now. I'll end with a final point, and this is something that has really been so striking to me, is how is it that these Palestinians who are so bereft, and so bereft of any kind of military or international power, how are they the source of so much fear? And I think this is another pattern that we see historically, when the dispossessed are actually a source of such fear. And in each of these issues, each of these editor's notes, I've tried to highlight the plight of a specific Palestinian academic as they face attempts of silencing. In the first editor's note that I did on my own, it was the case of Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian. And in this piece, it's the case of Rabia Aghbariyi, who wrote a piece about the Nakba, in which he was trying to really highlight the Nakba as a legal category, which faced a whole infrastructure of silencing from the Harvard Law Review to the Columbia Law Review, an infrastructure that he was able in the end to, at least for now, overcome. So in the face of all of that, I think this is one of the challenges of what it means to be colonized, which is you have all of these forces that are so much larger than you, and the temptation is to center those forces and analyze them, but the responsibility is to center Palestinian life. It isn't only to narrate the destruction, but to center Palestinian life and its experience of that destruction. So with that, I will just read a short bit about Wajihah, who is a woman who gave birth in genocide that I tried to accompany. Wejha's contractions started at 9 p.m. on October 29, 2023. She had fled her home a few weeks earlier. Her spouse was stuck in the United Arab Emirates. The anxiety and fear that pierced her exceeded the pain of the baby's imminent arrival. Like all pregnant women in Gaza, Wejha had no access to running water, a clean toilet, ultrasounds, blood pressure cuffs, stethoscopes, or painkillers. She worried about her blood pressure, a leading cause of maternal death. She worried about her amniotic fluid. She worried about the baby's position. She worried about the baby's heartbeat. When the contractions started, Wejha and her mother braved the shelling and managed to secure an ambulance. They made it to Al Awda Hospital in Nusayrat refugee camp. It was dilapidated, destroyed, and overcrowded. The maternity ward had become an urgent care unit. The flow of casualties was constant. The injured bled out onto the floor. Screams bounced off the walls. Within an hour, Wejha gave birth to the tempo of Israeli shelling. Every 5 minutes, she hid the baby in her clothes, hoping to shield the newborn from shattered glass. Like most women who gave birth in a hospital, she was discharged within 3 hours of delivering. With no choice but to keep moving, Wejha and her mother braved the streets again, this time with a newborn tucked in the folds of their exhaustion and despair. It took 3 hours to secure a car. And there I go on with how Wejha actually was lucky in the context that she was in, because she had a natural birth, because the baby lived. And then I give a sense of, you know, really what it means to be a mother, to be an expecting mother in the midst of a genocide. I mean, I think about this all the time. What does it mean to carry life, you know, in this moment? And then to basically be left on your own to deal with the complications of childbirth.
Let me read a tiny bit, because please, it goes right to this. To parent in genocide is to exist in fragments between life and death. Every hour, Israel kills 2 women in the Gaza Strip. Every day, 37 children lose their mothers. Every pregnant woman lives in the interstices of anticipation and terror, giving birth amidst death. Every pregnant woman looks on to a landscape of miscarriage, stillbirth, premature birth, and congenital abnormalities. They survive blood clots, multiple displacements, witnessing their children ravaged by shrapnel, disease, and hunger. They take recourse in all that is left for them to make bread, animal feed. I'm going to stop there and note that it is in the specificity and in the generality that you bring to this piece that the argument for Nakba denialism, or for whether or not this is a genocide, is just destroyed. Yeah. You cannot be reasonable and call out the facts only that you want to hear.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead. Okay.
I just wanted to say that one of my concerns and fears is that in the kind of large numbers, that it's these stories that we lose. And I think I've tried really, you know, to think about the first editor's note I did on my own focused on the children, because this genocide has targeted children inordinately. And as Ghassan Abu Sitti has taught us, the surgeon, that this genocide has produced the largest cohort of children with amputees ever historically. And so I think, you know, this goes back to your point earlier about the maiming. And, you know, I think of Jasbir Pawar's book, The Right to Maim, that we began to see in the first intifada, one at the time Yitzhak Rabin said, break their bones, right? And so this kind of, you know, I'm so haunted by the stories of these individuals. And I'm trying to at least record those for the archive in the future.
May I read the last bit?
Please.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip birth, shelter, and imagine life in a new stage of the Nakba. Existing in the interstices between past and future, debility and loss, Palestinian parents in the Gaza Strip wrest life from death, hope from despair, cohesion from fragments. Their grief is a portal through time and place. We follow their directive to, quote, leave the door to the tent ajar and put a dish of lentil soup on the floor. The kids could wake up from their graves hungry any time. And that's the end of it. But now I've just blanked on the author's name, on the poet's name.
His name is Musab Abu Toha, and you can follow him on Twitter.
Right.
And he does actually, this last quote was something he translated from a friend of his.
Shireen, let me let you have a last word, as you should. And just as a lead into that, it's stunning how many people that we've seen quoted who are writing, who are in the in Gaza or elsewhere, who are no longer with us, who
Absolutely.
Have been part of the toll of all of this. But for you, last word.
I guess I would just say that the work ahead is to somehow balance the broader struggle with this specificity. And I think that is the work of detail that we all must really embark on. The detail, the labor of detail, the labor of collective, collaborative work, however painful and difficult that is, in order for us to imagine a free Palestine and a free life for all of us, because I think Palestine is a microcosm for so many things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you remind me of A.C. Venanden's novel. It's titled When Memory Dies. Mm-hmm. And that's just unacceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't let it die.
Thank you so much, Shireen Sikli.
Thank you.
All of your work, but for this today too.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. It's an honor to be here with you.
That was Elizabeth Robinson's interview with Shireen Sekely, Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Santa Barbara and editor of the Journal of